her palm against mine. Annie smiles suddenly, breathlessly, at the completion of a turn, and I feel an irrepressible smile answer hers. And then the sorrow is transformed into something more, something beautiful. And this movement that is so tantalizingly close to flying, that's like the high notes of a violin, some mix of joy and pain, is part of that transformation. It's a fragile balance, and I know it can't last, but it seems as long as we're here dancing the Medean, all of these things can be reconciled and held together as one. The music descends, and in its lull, the other two squadron leaders join us on the floor for the final movement, Chrissa with Lotus for the Skyfish Squadron, and Kor with Alexa for the Storm Scourge. Echoing, for those who remember it, the dance of the Triarchs. And for a moment, though the banners hanging overhead are still the new regimes, the colours streaking across the floor are once again the tricolour of the old, Aurelian red, Skyfish blue, and Storm Scourge black. And then the last turn, the last resolve, and Annie is back in my arms, still, except for her heaving breaths. It's finished. She's standing so close that I feel the heat of her body radiating against mine. Her face is upturned. The roots of her hair are glistening with sweat. My face is bent toward hers. Then the applause starts and the moment breaks. We step away from each other. Alongside the other two couples, I bow, she curtsies, and I lead her off the floor. I am still strangely, painfully happy. And for one bright, oblivious instant, I envision this moment continuing, her remaining with me, alone, and the night wearing on with no one but each other for company. But then she points out Duck and Lotus. They're sitting in the semi-darkness at a table on the edge of the hall, Duck waving. The vision fades. I tell her, "You go on." Her fingers find mine, twist and pull. "Come with me." And all the hope comes rushing back. We make our way over. In the afterglow of the dance, it feels instinctive to guide Annie with a touch below her shoulder blades as we move through the hall, to allow my gaze to linger on her hair, beginning to trail in wisps from its bun, tickling her neck and glowing red in the candlelight. Duck scoots to the side to make room for us, and when we sit, Annie's side touches mine ever so slightly on the bench. Though I'm certain she must feel it too, she makes no move to create distance. I am aware of every inch along my side where we touch.
"We were admiring your dancing," Duck tells us, grinning.
All around the hall, men and women are getting up to waltz. Annie rolls her eyes to the ceiling.
"No, really. Loads better than my brother."
"Congratulations on your dad's poetry prize," I tell Lotus.
As I speak, I feel Annie's fingers find mine again, roll them into hers on our knees beneath the table, and a feeling like dizziness comes over me. Hours left, and we're still together, and she's smiling. Smiling while she holds my hand.
"Thanks," Lotus says. "It's been a long time coming. My dad had a bit of trouble finding patronage for his poetry after the revolution."
At Duck's look of confusion, Lotus draws a finger across his throat.
"Dead patrons don't pay well."
I can barely hear him, mesmerized as I am by Annie's hand in mine. How long has it been since Annie touched me like this? Surely it was never like this. Her fingers twining with mine as though she wanted to feel every line and burn scar with the tips of her fingers. A blush creeping up her cheeks, as if she feels my gaze on her and it brings heat to her skin. Could it possibly be this easy? This simple? Lotus cocks his head, lowers his voice, and leans forward conspiratorially. He jerks his chin behind us.
"Are you listening to this?"
The faces at the neighbouring table are indistinguishable in the semi-darkness, but their loud voices are unmistakably those of freshly graduated Lyceans, speaking in dragon tongue.
"You'd want him as the next protector?" "From the Riders in the Fourth, yes. Why, who would you pick?"
Annie's hand has stilled in mine, her smile frozen. Lotus sits back, looks between me and Annie, and tips the wineglass to his lips like he's settling in to be entertained. Duck, whose dragon tongue has always been weak, looks mostly confused. I begin tentatively to run my fingers over Annie's stilled hand, tracing the calluses on slender fingers, the trails of smooth scars across her palm. like I'm willing it back to life, back to me. It's simple, it's easy, it's just like the dancing, please. The boy's voice says,
Not Power Sewer Eater, because he's always been such a cocky ass. Core Sewer Marana, maybe, but honestly, probably Lee Sewer Palor, especially if he wins First Rider.
My hand stills too, holding Annie's, frozen.
A slum rat? The girl's voice scoffs. Did you see him doing the Medean just now? Or have you had a class with him? He doesn't act like a slum rat.
Practically looks like a storm scourge. The last line is an afterthought that the boy seems to think nothing of, but Annie's whole body stiffens, and then her hand comes back to life at last. She separates her fingers from mine and returns them to her lap. The happy, dizzy feeling dies. I reach for my glass with the hand no longer holding Annie's and begin to drain it. You think it ever could stop mattering? The next thing the boy says makes me freeze mid-swallow.
Anyway, better than a former serf. I mean, it's a good sob story, sure. I'll grant she's a poster child for the revolution.
Annie's eyes flare wide as we hear their scandalized snorts of laughter. She begins blinking rapidly, her bare shoulders going up and tightening at the sound. Lotus looks down, lifting a hand to rub at his forehead. Duck's eyes travel between the three of us, his brow furrowed.
What have you got against serfs ruling? The girl teases. Nothing, I'm just not convinced it's a qualification.
The conversation moves on. Some of the graduates in the party are getting up to dance. Annie lifts her head like one waking from a dream, and then she seems to realize her body's position in space and that her side still touches mine. She shifts an inch sideways on the bench. Though it's a slight movement, the distance that suddenly separates our bodies feels like a chasm. There's a charge in the air between us, as if Annie is tensed for any attempt on my part to cross it. Then Duck, who barely speaks dragon tongue and whose only understanding of what's happened comes from what he's read in our faces, gets to his feet and extends his hand to Annie. The hair he slicked back in the boys' washroom a few hours ago is sticking up at the back in spikes.
Dance with me.
Annie lifts her eyes wide and overbright to his face. You don't like dancing.
I'd like dancing with you.
But still she hesitates, and with a slight shift of her head, her face angles toward mine, as if my presence informs her answer. An old desire wells up within me, its pain so familiar, it returns like exhaustion. I would give anything to ease the hurt on this girl's face. Anything.
You should go, I say. You'll have fun.
Annie's eyes are wide beneath dark lashes as she searches my face. Then she nods. She rises, takes Duck's outstretched hand and follows him to the floor. There's silence after they've left us. Lotus still seems a little embarrassed. He clears his throat and claps his hand on my shoulder.
Still, good news for you, isn't it? The gold's favour.
I watch Annie's smile flickering, laughing unwillingly as Duck tries to dance. The pain is slowly receding from her eyes. I hear myself say, Yeah. There's darkness for a time after that. I'm aware of the night continuing, of Lotus's wandering off to visit with his mother and father, and of my sitting alone on the edge of the hall, unable to summon up the energy to leave. Annie is still dancing with Duck. You thought she could be happy with you? That she could ever forget?
There you are. We've been looking everywhere for you.
What are you doing here, sitting alone in the dark?
Cor and Krissa have taken seats on either side of me, Cor punching me in the arm. He follows the gaze that I'm too slow to retract.
My brother's a horrible dancer, he observes.
Krissa looks at Annie and Duck, then turns to me and puts her hand on my knee.
We've been talking, Cor and I. Have you been training for the First Rider tournament?
I rouse myself.
You mean in all my free time? Ha ha, we wanted you to know. We'll train with you.
I look from one of them to the other, shadows in the candlelight, but their faces turned toward mine, their bodies angled inward. Suddenly, the only thing that matters is that they're here, on either side of me.
You don't have time for that. We'll make time. We want you to win, Lee.
It's surprising, after an evening of being told variations of this from old men of the geniculum, how different it is coming from Cor and Chryssa. A vote of confidence from within the core that I hadn't realized that I needed. I really appreciate that. Thank you. The music changes, a new set has begun. The sound of Highland pipes is filling the hall with a pounding rhythm. The violin has become faster, playful. It's the kind of melody that was never played, never wanted, at the balls of the old regime. Annie, about to quit the floor, has her hand seized by Rock. I watch her protest half-heartedly, laughing, then allow Rock to lead her in a few bounds back into the centre of the floor. Most of its occupants are younger, alumni among the youngest generations of the Lyceum, cheering with enthusiasm to begin a different kind of dance. Around the hall, older faces are looking on with thinly disguised disapproval, but those dancing don't notice. Annie and Rock have begun mimicking each other with shouts of delight, their fingers twined together as they lean back. Annie's hair falls free of its pins and tumbles down her back, but she hardly seems to notice. The Highland rhythm is so powerful that it seems to catch you in your stomach, take hold of your legs, so that even seated, all you want to do is move your feet. There's a swapping of partners, and now Annie dances with a lanky straw-haired ministry official who beams as he swings her outward, and then she's back in Duck's arms. Chryssa takes my hand, squeezes, and I look at her. Her dress, blue as the Medean, exactly matches her eyes, and her hair glows warm and gold in the candlelight. "I think it's time we took you for some fresh air," she says.
Annie.
Duck and I walk back to the cloister in the early morning, when the sky is no longer quite so inky black. Duck hums the last song, his coat swinging over one shoulder. I hold my shoes by their heels on the hooks of my fingers, the marble of the palace walkways cool beneath my aching feet. Duck's voice echoes in the deserted courtyard. "Can you believe we live here?" The courtyard smells of cold stone and the cool water that burbles in the fountains. Columns along the arcade rise to vaulted overhangs above us, where tendrils of ivy hang silhouetted against the stars. Distantly, a gull cries. "Can you believe we ride dragons?" He rounds on his heel, takes a few steps backward. "Can you believe I just danced?" I laugh aloud. "And not too badly by the end," I grant. This, I realize, must be what giddiness feels like escape. As though for a few short hours, as I danced until my hair fell from its pins, I left behind every bitter thought that haunts me and was free. Most of all, the memory of Lee's hand in mine, the rush of old comfort thrilling with new danger, and his face when I pulled away, like I just pulled him apart. We've reached the cloister garden. The rippled glass of the solarium glows orange, a fire lit within. We won't be alone when we enter. I reach for the door handle and Duck takes my hand, pausing it. I turn to him.
"Oh, not so fast."
He pulls me back to him, and as I realize what is about to happen, I freeze. And then, with dizzying speed, 100 small incidents click into place like a narrative whose common thread I did not, until this moment, let myself see. "Oh, dragons, how did I not know this was coming? Duck, I don't..." He stops too. For a moment, we continue to stand close, frozen, and I feel the threat of an end rise over us. An end of something that could have started and that I was almost certain I did not want. And worse, more terrifyingly, an end now to what we already had. But then Duck takes a half step back and lights a smile. And even if it's not quite as easy as his usual smile, it's close. Crinkling his eyes, spreading across his square face.
Hey, it's okay, Annie.
The lingering uncertainty as I take in the strain around his eyes.
Is it?
Let's go in, I ask. That's when the alarm bells begin to toll.
Lee.
Early morning. Core is asleep. Krissa and I are beside him on a deserted part of the outer wall where we had originally decided to climb for a view of the city. The fire that we'd lit has gone out. The stone is cold. Krissa is warm. And the wineskin that we were passing back and forth is long empty. I feel like I'm moving in and out of a dream. In the dream, her hands are in my hair, mine are around her waist, and her mouth is on mine. Is that what it felt like for her dancing with Duck, I wonder? Did she feel free and forgetful with him, like this? Whenever I rouse from the dream and remember why it's something I shouldn't have, the conversations begin again. Krissa, this isn't... We shouldn't. Even in the near darkness, I can see her lips parting in a smile. Our faces are so close, I can see stars reflected in her eyes. We shouldn't what? This time I'm the one to answer by pulling her closer, by bringing us both back under. Because though I sense dimly a future of guilt spreading out on the horizon, it still feels a long way off. And in the meantime, Chris's lips have opened mine with need. We break apart when the bells begin to toll. Krissa groans, lowers her face onto my shoulder, her hair still spread across us both. As I recognize the bells' tones, the blurred world snaps back into focus.
How is it already morning? She asks.
Those aren't striking the hour. Krissa stills, and then she places a palm on the flagstones to push her weight off mine. The chill of the morning invades the space between us. The east is pink below a sky rippling with low-hanging stratus clouds. A single beacon has lit on the northern tower of the inner palace. Below it, the alarm bell rings. Beside us, Kor is stirring, wincing from the noise. Cold dread rolls over me, dousing any lingering warmth from wine. I knew it. I should have said something. I shouldn't have let us take down our guard. Krissa and I get to our feet as one and turn our sights out over the sleeping city. A trail of beacons mounted on dragon perches have lit through the neighborhoods, vanishing in the distance of the lowland plains leading to the north coast, a trail of light leading to the source of alarm. The bells are rhythmic, tolling in the patterned code we were taught to interpret as children but have never since had reason to use. Dragons. Attack.
Chapter 9. Starved Rock. Lee.
The lull of the ball is sliding away. All at once, Julia's words are ringing in my ears. We will strike first to spread fear. My fault, my stupid fault for doing nothing. For letting Holmes make a call that I knew left us absurdly exposed. But there's no point in self-recrimination right now. No time for it. I seize Kor by the arm and pull him to his feet, half-woken. Krissa presses her hand to her forehead and inhales as the fullness of our unpreparedness rolls over her.
We need to get into the air, and they're not even saddled, and I'm in this dress!
She clutches her gown in disgust, for what good is such clothing against dragonfire? Kor focuses at last on the tolling bell, the burning beacons, and begins to swear like a chant, rhythmically. I shake him till he looks at me, then seek Chris's eyes.
We've drilled this!
Krissa shakes her head, clearing it. Then she hums, like a recitation.
Get to the armory and suit up while the keepers saddle the dragons, summon from the arena gate.
We don't have far to sprint. The stretch of the outer wall on which we stand connects directly to the cloister by means of a trapdoor and a ladder, which we scramble down, and then we hurtle through a single corridor to the armory entrance.
Where do you want us?
Kor asks while we're running. The question is directed at me, even though the three of us are, as squadron leaders, equally ranked. But only after I've begun to answer do I remember that, or feel surprised that he's asked me.
Skyfish squadron ahead,
Aurelian and Storm Scourge half-squadrons coming in behind. We'll leave the other half-squadrons covering the city. We can't leave it unprotected. Follow the trail of beacons to the attack, but when you get there, limited attacks only, Chrissa. Hold them off until we can catch up with you.
We've reached the armory. Chrissa seizes my arm before entering, pulling me to a halt. Kor pauses too, swinging on the doorframe. Inside, the armory is full of riders, shouting, scrambling to suit up. Many of them are, like us, still in formal wear.
Lee, what are we? Someone calls from within. We're going to give orders in the air. Just suit up and get to the gate. You're fine, I call, before turning back to Chrissa.
Her hair falls in half-pinned clumps from what remains of her bun, loose around her shoulders. In the dark corridor, the blue of her dress looks black against her hair. Her eyes are wide, her chest heaving.
And if it's too late? She asks.
What do you mean?
If it's an extraction?
She's clutching the cinched waist of her gown, gasping to catch her breath from the sprint. Kor reaches out an arm to steady her at the elbow.
Lee, if they've already...
If they've already landed fire. A single dragon is still enough to level a town. What will Chrissa's skyfish find when they get there? Dragons waiting for them, or just the dragon fire they've left behind?
If they've already come, get in wherever the fire's gone down and bring anyone still moving on the blaze site out.
We've drilled that too. But all the same, it seems hearing the procedure recited aloud is what Chrissa needed. She calms once I've said it, her face hardening. Inside, we strip. Those coming directly from the ball are lacking their usual underlayers, but there's no time for shame. Chrissa wrenches her dress up over her shoulders as confidently as if she were in a room alone. I note in a half glance, with a kind of numb disbelief, that a trail of flushed skin spreading down her neck was my doing, and that the memory already feels remote. The door bursts open and Annie enters, followed by Duck. Her hair is disheveled, her sleeves low and uneven on her shoulders. I have a half second to wonder whether she and Duck were occupied as Chrissa and I were, before she's beside me in the Aurelian row, seizing the flame suit from her cubby next to mine, reaching awkwardly behind her shoulders for the clasp of her dress. She curses.
Lee,
she hisses. Give me your boot knife. I slice the dress open down her back, the luxurious fabric rips like paper. She shoves it off with vindictive fury and dives for her flame suit, a flash of bare skin that I turn my back on at once. We shimmy into our flame suits without looking at each other.
You want me on left or right, Vanguard? She calls over her shoulder.
I think of Chrissa's white face as she said the word extraction. We will strike first to spread fear. How many minutes have passed since the first beacon lit? How many since we saw the last? What is the likelihood, if any, that the Pythians will still be there? Annie may be one of the fleet's strongest assets in battle, but for an extraction? For a blaze site. Annie, who clutched my hand so tightly at the sight of Duck injured by unsparked Storm Scourge fire that her nails left marks, facing in all likelihood a scene of devastation by dragonfire, the likes of which she hasn't seen since Holbin. No, that at least I can spare her. The answer comes out curt.
Neither. I need you and Power covering the city with your half squadrons. We can't leave it undefended.
I realize only after I've said it what Annie will take from this. Defending is traditionally the role of the Alternus. She freezes, midway through tightening her cuirass. For a moment, her fingers open and close on the buckles in time with her breath. And then she lifts her head and looks at me. Power speaks first. Unlike my and Annie's voices, his is raised for the room to hear. He stands 2 yards away, separated by the benches between the Aurelian row and Storm Scourge, paused in the act of lifting his cuirass over his head.
You're already ordering Antigone to defend. Is that a joke? First Rider tournament's still 2 weeks away, Lee.
Power is glaring at me, disgusted. The disgust isn't new. Having it turned on me on behalf of Annie is. He's picked a hell of a time for it. At his challenge, riders around us fall silent and exchange glances. Annie's brown eyes are still fixed on me, her lips parted. When she speaks, her voice is quiet, close to a whisper, as if determined, despite the scene power seems bent on creating, to keep our conversation private. I want to be part of the counterattack. My voice lowers too, hissing the words that I need to make her understand. We're already too late for a counterattack. Annie blinks, as if she hears, though I haven't said it, the word implicit. Blaze sight. But whatever I expect her to make of that, it's not the contortion of her disappointment into a twisted smile of newfound realization as she continues to look at me. As if I have, somehow, just managed to hurt her in any entirely different way. Instead of explaining herself, she breathes with that same expression, so twisted with pain and surprise it almost looks amused. Yes, sir. She turns away and continues arming with jerking movements. Power, who's made no effort to disguise the fact that he's continued to listen, lets out a snort behind me that makes me practically jump. So that's what this is about, he says at full volume, sneering. Annie's history? You've got a lot of nerve, Lee. Glances down the row are being shot anew in our direction by other guardians. Cor, two cubbies down from Power, has actually stopped suiting up as he assesses the confrontation. And Chris's frown in my direction makes it clear that as far as she's concerned, I'm on the wrong side of this argument. But by now I'm too angry to care. Since when has anything between Annie and me been any of their business? Power has no idea what he's talking about. My fingers are tightening on my leg guards as I strap them on, my jaw clenching. But before I can answer, Annie lifts her head from her armor and turns it toward Power. We have orders. The keep needs defending. Suit up. To my surprise, Power doesn't argue with her. Chrissa has finished arming first from her squadron, and her voice is the next to fill the room. She's moved to the doorway where she bellows at the remainder of her riders. Let's move, people! Weapons, shields, canteens! Outside in the growing light beside the arena gate, riders arrive two by two at intervals of 30 seconds. Dragons emerge from the caves and barely land before their riders mount. Keepers are ready at the mouth to help strap boots into stirrups and tighten girths. The Skyfish squadron departs first. When they're off, Cor and I begin launching our own riders. And then, at last, I'm mounting Palor, kicking off, and leaving Annie and her blank face behind with the defending half squadrons. She thinks she can handle a blaze sight? Fine. But she shouldn't expect me to wait on her pride when Kallipolan lives are at stake. I have more to worry about than her need to prove herself. In fact, I have family to worry about. Only in the air does that reality finally hit. Yes, it might be a blaze sight, but what if it's not? What if we aren't too late? Or it's Julia waiting on Dragonback, or Ixion, or some other long-lost friend or relative? What will I do?
Annie.
When Power and I land with our half squadrons on the ramparts to take watch, it's the first time we've ever alighted on Pytho's keep for anything more than a training exercise. Tonight, in the growing dawn, all I can make out of the citadel and ramparts are rugged silhouettes against the grey sky. The city below us is toy-like in the half-light, miniature spires over miniature rooftops. The river glints with the reflected sunrise. The lowland plains stretch out in rolling lines of blue toward the sea to the east. The highlands rise to the west. We watch the rest of the fleet follow the trail of beacons north, their winged silhouettes diminishing against the horizon. I watch them, and remember Lee's face at our first sighting of the Pythian fleet. And now that boy, whose face I've seen fill with longing at the sight of our enemy, has ordered me to wait behind while he goes out to face them. He's right. We probably will be too late. And it would have gutted me to see it. But that doesn't undo the absurdity of the fact that under threat by dragonfire from people whom Lee counts as family, he just questioned my fitness to face them. How often have I longed for this boy's comfort? How often have I remembered and missed how much easier it was in Albin's when I could still seek it from him? But now I know what that feels like, delivered, unsolicited, and unneeded. Because it's one thing to be written off by Goran, by the Minister of Propaganda, by every single teacher I've ever had or ministry official I've ever done rounds with. It's another thing entirely to be written off by Lee. And there's more to it than just my injured pride. Will Lee's determination to keep faith with Kallipolis hold if they aren't too late and he does face family? And if it doesn't hold, who will be able to stop him if I'm not there to do it? Who else in the Corps has even a hope of matching Lee if it comes down to that? I should be out there. On one side, Power waits quietly beside me, and I sense his anticipation for me to break the silence. On my other side, Ayla, her presence like a fire in the back of my mind. When I reach my arm out and lay it on her wing joint, she turns to look at me. Her horned face fills my vision, blocking out the ramparts and the city below and the pink horizon. And as I stare into her golden eyes, the memory rises like a vision. My father. His voice flowing in my memory from another lifetime, gruff with an accent that my own voice lost long ago. You see, Annie, they watch us kneel. They see the back of our heads, and they think we've given in. They don't realize you can think from your knees just as well as from your feet. A calloused hand, large enough to cut my face, tilts my chin up to look at him as he crouches to my height. The lined eyes, the conspiring smile of a man I once believed would always be there to protect me. And then the vision fades, and I finally understand. My father taught me the form of courage that he needed. The courage of thinking from your knees. That was what we had. But today, as I stood in front of Lee Sir Palor, I realized I'm done with my father's kind of courage. I felt how those words tasted. Yes, sir, to a dragon lord's son, sour and familiar like old milk turned. And I realized that if I don't like how those words taste, it's up to me to do something about it. I'm done thinking from my knees. It's time to think from my feet. All the while, Power stands beside me, silent, waiting. The dawnlight renders him little more than an armored silhouette at Eater's side. A distant part of myself is angry with him, furious. But the rest of me recognizes that, right now, how I feel about Power is irrelevant. When are you free to train? Power doesn't express surprise or triumph or make any remark at all. Tomorrow, before patrols. I've got a free block. Good. We'll start then.
Lee.
The coastline has appeared blue-gray in the early morning. For a heart-stopping instant, I think the trail of beacons leads to Fort Aeron and its town off Aeron's Cove, one of the few population centers along the northern coast. But then I realize the beacons continue past it. A mile from the fort off the coast, a single island is ablaze. It fills the cove with the light of its fire. And then nothing, gray sea to the horizon. No signs of hostile dragons, nor the streaks of fire that would show our skyfish locked in sparring matches with sparked dragonfire. They lit the island and left. And some part of me, some awful, cowardly part of me, is relieved. As we approach, I smell it, sulphurous and heady. A scent I haven't smelled in years. Dragonfire. I kick Palor down into a dive, leading the Aurelian and Storm Scourge squadrons into descent. Winged black silhouettes are dipping in and out of the blaze, the skyfish already on the sight. The island is tiny, sparsely populated, and the entirety of its few shacks are on fire. A fleet of rescue boats, a combination of civilian vessels and naval ships from Fort Aaron, have congregated at a safe distance off the shore, and Chris's skyfish dart back and forth from them to the burning island, ferrying whomever they've been able to find to safety. I slice my bootstraps to leap off as we descend. On the ground, flames are still licking the buildings around us, wood snapping and cracking, and other guardians are calling frantically as they search. Even protected by a flame suit and the filter of my visor, the heat makes me lightheaded. And once I begin coughing, I can't stop.
Lee! Here!
Lotus and Duck are struggling to lift fallen beams, still partially afire, from the entryway of a burning building. As we clear it, a crash comes within, a floor falling through. Duck raises his arm over his visored face, preparing to go in, when I seize him.
It's not sound, no! There are people in there, Lee! We can hear them!
He's straining against me as, with another crash, the roof collapses in flames. I have to haul him backward.
It's too late, Duck!
Annie.
The sun rises as I look out over the city, simmering with the feeling of my own powerlessness. Surely there is no hell like this waiting, this wondering. What are they facing, and who will return? The sun is high in the sky by the time the fleet reappears on the horizon. In the interim, my imagination has had time to work, and so when we see them, my relief spirals into unexpected exhaustion. They're all right. They're safe. I assign a lingering guard on the keep, and the rest of us descend. Once back in the caves, my feet take me, not up to the armory, but down the cave corridor. I find Duck in the skyfish nests, where he's unsaddling Serta with shaking fingers, his pupils still dilated from spillover. He's blackened from soot and reeks of sparked dragonfire. The smell is enough to awaken memories that bring bile to my mouth. Annie, are you hurt? It's difficult to believe that, mere hours ago, we were laughing together as we tried to dance, or that for a few heartbeats I looked up at him and feared that I was about to lose him over something as trivial as a kiss. Duck shakes his head. Lee and some of the others are still there, he manages, as if forming the words costs him. Collecting accounts from survivors. And then his face, soot blackened, crumples. And that's enough for me to know what happened. They saw no combat. Lee faced no one. But what they did see was almost certainly worse. I'm not surprised by the memories that rise with my understanding, but I am surprised by the calmness that settles over me as they do. The sudden rooted sense of place. This is familiar. This I know. These are the paths I've wandered in and out of sleep for a lifetime.
Lee.
The island, called Starved Rock, is one of the handful of vassal islands on the northern coast of Kallipolis, named for its barren landscape and a legendary tragedy that took place on it during the Aurelian invasion. Because of its sparse population, it wasn't provided with additional fortification in the last month. It was assumed to be too close to the greater target of Fort Aaron to be endangered. In the end, the casualty count is low. 7 out of a total population of 26. The accounts confirm 2 storm scourge dragons and 1 skyfish, who departed after setting fire to the buildings rather than remaining to finish the job. Those who woke in time to escape the fires were not pursued. Except for one, who finds me on the galley where survivors are being counted and their burns tended. The day has dawned grey and clouded. The deck of the ship rocks gently on the swells.
Are you Lee Sorpalor?
The boy, fair-haired beneath soot, has a blanket around his shoulders and a mug of tea he doesn't drink between still shaking hands. He's risen from where he was sitting on the deck with his parents and sister. Yes?
I was given a message from Julia Stormscourge.
The deck is already quiet, despite the number of people on it, but at his words it falls completely silent. The lapping of waves and the gulls overhead are all we can hear. The sound of Julia's name on this stranger's tongue fills me with numb dread.
For me?
The boy nods.
For the first rider,
he says.
For the first rider and the first protector.
The boy's voice is too strained for me to think of contradicting him. Beneath so much soot, his expression is indiscernible, although it makes his eyes appear white-rimmed. Krissa and Lotus, crouched nearby to go over accounts from other survivors, have risen to their feet. Krissa has lifted her hand to cover her mouth.
She landed, spoke to me, made me memorize it before.
He leaves the sentence unfinished. My voice comes out hoarse.
Go on.
The boy inhales, then recites.
Consider this a taste. This was the work of 3 sparked dragons, but soon there will be more. We will continue until Kallipolis is ours again, and the next time we won't be so merciful. You have until Palace Day to change your minds. Do you really want to make more?
But here the boy pauses, eyes scanning my face as if remembering something about me, and it makes him hesitate.
More. Do you really want to make more orphans of Kallipolans?
Chapter 10. Sparring Partners. The boy and the girl were the only children from their orphanage who scored high enough on the metals test to be invited to the choosing ceremony. On the awaited day, the boy was alive with excitement. Somehow, against all odds, he was back in the inner palace, and he was about to attend a choosing ceremony, his birthright. The girl did not share his excitement. They were on the threshold of the Hall of the Triarchs, standing in the line of waiting children, about to be presented to dragons, and she was shaking from head to foot. I don't want to go in there. After a year of unease about the idea of this test, of commoners attending choosing ceremonies, the boy's only thought now, when he looked at the girl, was that something extraordinary was about to happen, and he didn't want her to miss it. Without pausing to consider it, he took her hand. We'll do it together. Inside the hall, high above them, on the balcony, the boy could see a few adults gathered, watching the ceremony. The boy himself had stood there when his brother had been presented at a choosing. Now, looking up at the balcony, the boy spotted the man who had saved him. They passed the first hatchling, a slender, purple-tinged skyfish, dog-sized. Its eyes passed over them without interest, and they continued on. See? Easy, he murmured to the girl. They're just babies, can't even breathe fire yet. Unless they choose you, they don't even notice you. She didn't ask how he knew this. Her eyes were fixed on the exit at the other side of the room. They passed another skyfish, then a third. He thought they were doing quite well until he felt her freeze beside him. They had reached the Storm Scourge section. For an instant, his only thought was, finally! His family's dragons. He was home. But then he looked at the girl and saw her face crumpling with fear. Looking at the Storm Scourges, his Storm Scourges, with such terror on her face that tears began to pour down it. He felt as though something inside him was breaking apart. Come on, he said. He wrapped his arm around her and pulled her forward, past all the great, beautiful Storm Scourges that he'd always dreamed of flying, barely looking at them, because all he could focus on was the feeling of the girl's shoulders shaking as he led her on. They won't hurt you. Come on. And then it was over. He hadn't been chosen. But it didn't matter. Suddenly it didn't matter at all. See, we're done. It's done. He turned to her, desperate to see the look of despair gone from her face, ignoring the plummeting feeling of his own. He was surprised to see something else. Instead of staring at her feet, the girl was looking up, past him, He followed her gaze and saw that she was looking at an Aurelian, and that the Aurelian was looking back at her. He'd heard it said before that a kind of magic came with a dragon choosing you, that the dragon bound you to it, that you formed a connection that was deep and full of an old magic. His father had always told him this was simply a myth, that it was a matter of imprinting, and that there was nothing mystical about it. But he couldn't help thinking, as he watched the girl's face transform, that he was seeing something unearthly. The girl who, a moment ago, had been cowering against him, now released his hand as if she had forgotten it. She took one step toward the dragon, then another, never taking her eyes off the dragon's face. When they stood nose to nose, she stretched out a hand and laid it between the dragon's eyes. The boy was so entranced that he didn't stop to wonder what was nudging him until he turned to acknowledge it. Then he looked up into a pair of great, liquid black eyes, and everything around him stood still. Lee.
I sit across from Atreus while he reviews my transcription of the Pythian's message to the boy from Starved Rock. The tomes of Dragon Tongue lining the shelves of his office contrast with the careful austerity of his desk, of the chairs we're sitting in, and his simple, unadorned uniform. Lines form around his mouth and forehead as he reads. When he finishes, he laces his fingers together and looks up. It's early afternoon, the day after the Lycian ball, but it feels like a year has passed between last night and today.
You handled this well, Lee.
The truth curdles in my stomach. I didn't handle this well. I let it happen. I let Holmes take down the aerial guard when I knew better, and he didn't. How are we going to reply? Atreus's voice is clipped with distaste. To the Pythians? We're not, for the time being. But our fleet hasn't sparked yet.
It will. I'm confident of that. They give us till Palace Day. A great deal can change in 3 weeks. I'm happy to wait them out.
The next objection comes to my lips before I can stop myself. What if it's not worth it? Atreus tilts his chin, untwines his fingers, lines them across his desk.
What if what's not worth it?
That boy's white-rimmed eyes, the smoking blaze site reached only a few minutes too late. What if it's just making more orphans of Kallipolans? This war. If it even comes to that, if we even spark, wouldn't it be better to...
To capitulate?
Compromise, I say hoarsely. What if there were a way to compromise? For one mad moment it's on the tip of my tongue. I imagine saying it, imagine telling him the whole thing. When I was a child, you saved me. And I believe in all of it, all we're doing. And Julia will listen to me, they'll listen to me, let me be the bridge. Let me have some way out of this besides facing them in the air. Atreus speaks first.
It is difficult, knowing that your choices are ones whose consequences others suffer.
His voice is soft, understanding, as if, though I've said nothing of how it felt to arrive on the scene on the back of a dragon and still find myself powerless, he understands exactly the weight it bore.
But that is the price of leadership. How exactly would you compromise with these people, Lee? They don't want our world. They want theirs. And that's something I will not allow. We are building something better.
Atreus's next words remove the possibility of uttering the truth like a candle snuffed of its flame.
You are the future of this country, Lee. A leader chosen, not born. There can be no compromise on that.
What would you say if I told you I was both? But that's not a question I dare ask. It's remarkable how, even this many years later, even trained in rhetoric myself, Atreus's words still have the power to make my spine tingle, even as he damns my own people with them. We are building something better. Familiar, calming. Atreus's vision, something to hold on to. Sweeping aside what came before it with such persuasive confidence. Better.
The qualms you have expressed are not ones you alone will have, he admits. particularly if our fleet remains unsparked.
He taps his fingers together, scans the papers lying across his desk like he's surveying a land campaign from the air. His tone becomes brisk.
It will be important that the people are assured. I'll speak to propaganda about measures to be taken.
Annie.
Power and I begin training the day after Starved Rock, following Atreus's speech in the People's Square. By that time, news of the attack has reached the capital from Fort Aaron. The crowd is unusually quiet as Atreus describes what happened after the beacons lit. Standing beside Lee among the onlooking guardians, I can't help but glance at his face as Atreus says certain words. Two Storm Scourge and one Skyfish. Survivor bearing a message from Julia Storm Scourge. We will not capitulate. We are certain that our fleet will spark soon. I wonder what's going on behind Lee's masked expression. What he saw. What he's remembering. What he's thinking. It's from Lotus, not Lee, that I learned it was a surviving child who delivered the message. Does that name mean anything to him? Julia Storm Scourge? What does he imagine when he hears the word capitulate, other than the return of a world that surely must tug at buried desires? And I wonder what is going on behind the eyes of the people who watch us. They're roaring by the end, roused by Atreus's words and voice. But even so, when Chryssa and I take the footpath alleyways through Highmarket back to the palace at the end of the address, the conversations whispered at street corners have a different tone.
At least with the Dragon Lords we could defend ourselves.
Not to mention with the Dragon Lords, my sons weren't getting paid a pittance from the Labor Draft Board.
Commoners and women riding dragons. Fat lot of good that does if the fleet can't spark.
Dora Mithridates's pseudoscientific rumor from the Lycian Ball seems to have trickled down to the lower class metals. When they see Chryssa and me, the huddle of whispering class bronzes unfolds to observe us, making our way down the footpath in guardian uniform, and while some elbow each other in sudden wariness, the most daring of them gives us a flourishing bow, bearing a sardonic, ragged-toothed grin.
Long live the revolution, Lady Guardians.
Citizen, Chryssa answers rigidly. We round the corner to the echoes of suppressed, bitter laughter going up behind us. I'm shaking, unnerved by their anger. Chryssa's lips are pressed tight, her fingers clenched to fists. Above us, the sign for the pickled boar swings over the tavern entrance. I realize with a start that the last time I visited this part of Highmarket, I was lifted on shoulders and offered free drinks. But now, when faces turn toward us, conversations slide into silence and lines form around mouths. At the palace gates we part ways, Chryssa to the inner palace and I to the cloister and the dragon caves to begin training with power. Ayla is curled in her nest, asleep beneath the wing that encloses her like a blanket, and when I crouch down to wake her, I drop for a moment to my knees, take her head in my hands, press my forehead against hers. Her slitted eyes snap open, and she lets out a rumble like a purr.
When are you going to spark?
But Ayla has no answer. All the dragons have been subjected to test after test from their keepers and from physicians attempting to spark them, all futile. Ayla's distemper at their visits reaches me all the way from the cloister. She yawns, revealing rows of razor-sharp teeth, and shakes herself to her feet. I throw her saddle over her back.
Time to go spend some time with your favorite Storm Scourge.
The eyrie is warmed with afternoon sunlight. Beneath my flame suit, I begin to break a sweat. A thin blanket of cirrus clouds coat the sky above us, washing out its blue and softening the sun's glare. Power waits for me, Eater lounging beside him, his wings flattened on the stone to warm in the sun. Ayla growls and bucks at the sight of them, giving me a reproachful look. Eater remains where he lounges, but his head spikes flatten as he growls back at her. "Don't look at me like that," I mutter, seizing her by the halter. "They're all right this time."
"Hell of a speech," Power remarks by way of greeting. "Nothing like a good dose of propaganda to start off your morning."
He eases himself down onto the stone next to Eater, rubbing him beneath the jaw, calming him. I sit too. It feels strange to sit for a conversation with Power. Even with a few meters between us, it seems dangerous, like laying down arms in front of an enemy. Ayla gives a sniffle of incredulity and eases onto her haunches beside me, so close her side presses against mine, warming me through my flame suit. Glaring at Eater, daring him to come closer. Her tail flicks back and forth, dragging on the flagstones. Power watches the hostile back and forth with lazy disinterest. "We still heard people talking about wanting dragon lords back afterward," I tell him. Power's lip curls. "People can be stupid." It's Power's usual condescension, but it reminds me, for the first time, of Dora's revelation about his parentage at the Lycian Ball. His anger, his defensiveness about a fact that would have meant nothing to me if he hadn't spent years humiliating me for a low birth that it turns out we have in common. I can't decide whether knowing the truth makes me like him more or less. He stretches, straining his arms above his head, the muscles in his shoulders rippling, like a cat arching its back, maintaining eye contact the whole time. Then he shakes them out. "If we're doing this, I want us to be clear on why. So, you tell me, Annie." I tell him the truth. "I don't want to be Lee's alterna." Power nods, then gazes over the empty tiers of the arena stands, rising like the sides of a bowl around us, his brow furrowed. This late in summer, the sun has turned his face a deep brown. He says, "But I'm not asking what you don't want. I'm asking what you do want. I'm asking why you want to win." And that's enough to stop me short. Power lifts a hand between us and begins to count off on his fingers. "Here are the facts. You're a finalist like Lee, his equal or better in every one of his classes, his only challenger in the air, his match on every count of trauma. You're every bit as qualified for first rider as he is. You're the only real threat he's ever had. But he doesn't see that. And I'm not sure you do either." At hearing my own abilities listed, without comment or anger, just flat facts, my discomfort rises, unbearable. "I do see all that, but..." Power waits, his lip curling for me to finish the objection. My face is burning, but I resist the urge to avert it. And then I hear myself list the weaknesses that haunt me as if compelled. I'm not as good with people. I don't lead like he does. I'll never be as good at charming anyone or making speeches or..." Power drums his fingers impatiently on Eater's scales. "Which might put you at a disadvantage for protectorship, sure. But to be a good first rider, you just need a head for strategy, skill in the air, and nerves of steel." For a moment, the shock of the words, their simplicity, prevents me from believing them. No. Surely it's not so simple. Surely I've not spent months doubting my place in the Fourth Order, only to realize what I should have seen from the start. When I say nothing,
Power leans forward. Tell me where you came from. For a moment I tense, primed for the disparagement of my background that he's usually so willing to give. But then, as Ayla's tail tightens its coil around me, I understand. Power isn't asking about my birth, or my poverty, or my lack of polish. He's asking what I did in spite of them. My answer comes in a whisper. I watched my family get taken by dragonfire at the age of 6, and I learned to ride anyway. Power's brown eyes are raking over my face, the same way they've always done when he asks me about Storm Scourge fire. But today, I experience it as something besides cruelty. Admiration.
Damn right you did, he murmurs.
He leans forward, placing his palms on the sun-baked stone of the eerie floor.
Now, tell me again why you want to make First Rider.
My fingers are wound tightly around Ayla's horns as I clench them. I let myself say it the way I should have said it from the start. Because I'd be good at it. Ayla and I don't know how to spill over intentionally. When Power learns this, he rubs at the line between his eyebrows and squints at me.
Of course you don't, he mutters. You really keep everything close to the chest, don't you, Annie?
I'm going to take that as a compliment. Power snorts, like he didn't mean it as one. Then he gets to his feet, dusts his hands together, and I get to my feet as well. Facing each other, standing on the eerie, it feels like we're back in familiar territory. Opponents. Eta and Ayla have tensed, sensing a change in the air.
So, what was it like, watching my match with Duck?
After years of Power's goads, I can see where this is going. I feel a ripple of closeness to Ayla, who's risen on her haunches beside me as my anger rises.
Don't. Power presses on relentless. Did you feel powerless? Were you scared for him?
Ayla is so close. I can practically feel her mind tickling my own as my breathing accelerates. My repulsion beginning to do its work on us, even as this becomes a game I no longer want to play.
Stop, Power, this isn't. Power lets out a bark of laughter. What's the matter, Annie? Did you think I was a nice person because I said I'd train with you? Do you want me to tell you how I felt during that match?
His own pupils are dilating. Eta rises to his haunches, lifts his head to the sky, and roars. They've spilled over. Power's smile has the frenzied energy of a dragon's influence.
No!
He leans forward, lowers his voice, and it cuts across the windswept eerie.
I felt bloody fantastic, because beating Duck has always hit the spot. Sometimes you've just got to kick a dog.
My fury bursts into Ayla with such force, it feels like a pot bursting from steam. There's a sudden rushing relief as my emotions flood into her. Her wings burst open, her horns go flat, and she bellows Ash. She and Eta are pawing the ground as they eye each other, poised to attack. Power, abruptly clinical, searches my eyes for the same pupil dilation I can see in his.
Good, he says, seeing it. Don't let the connection close. Let's get in the air.
I scramble onto Ayla, and we kick off from the ground like it's hateful to us. Sparring under spillover is hyperreal in the moment, but difficult to recall with clarity afterward. Power gives feedback in the air rather than on the ground, and his words come through the fogging haze of Ayla's emotions and my own.
That was sloppy. Do it again. Now again.
Still, for all his corrections, Power concludes the first practice with,
I knew you'd be suited to it. Same time tomorrow. I am still too sick with Ayla's and my anger, dulling but still hot to answer, and can only nod. When I return to the cloister, I find Duck in the courtyard, hunched on a bench. For a moment, all I can think of looking at him are Power's words, and a fierceness like fury rises up in me again. But then I remember that in the last 24 hours, Duck has shouldered burdens heavier and harder than Power's bullying. Of the 8 civilians the Skyfish first responders helped rescue, I learned from Lotus, Duck saved 5 of them. His neck is bandaged beneath his uniform from burns he sustained in the extraction. How are you doing? I ask. Duck pulls his shoulders together in a shrug and straightens. In the wake of the attack, I've been surprised by his ability. One I never had, and from what I can tell, Lee has never had either. To talk about the things that haunt him rather than keep them shut up inside. But that doesn't mean he takes any of what happened less hard. Duck hasn't talked about the ones they saved, just the ones they didn't. The burbling courtyard fountain and the trees rustling with songbirds are things he would usually point out to me, but today, he doesn't seem to see them. I'm okay. How was training? Duck's the only person I've told about my decision to train with Power, and he asks in a tone that suggests he can't imagine anything but the worst. I consider my answer, thinking of those things Power said. A dog to kick. Even as my rage pushed me and Ayla to new heights, through new boundaries, I hated him. And in that way, training with Power was the worst. But then I think of the single sentence Power elicited from me moments before he provoked the anger that changed everything. A head for strategy, skill in the air, and nerves of steel. I'd be good at it. I don't have to like Power for him to be right. For the first time since the tournaments began, I let myself imagine it. My name, appended by the single word that is both a title, a position, and a rank. Antigone Sir Ayla, First Rider. I can't help feeling as if the mere act of imagining these words together, let alone of believing I'm worthy of wanting them, is defiance. Defiance of every lingering prejudice of Kallipolis, of its ministry and their notes, and maybe most of all, defiance of myself.